is fine, that erase it.
The only question that had ever been raised about my being a candidate were months, several months before the convention. I can't place it for time, but I have a recollection that it was relatively warm out. Joe Ullman, I had been in Minnesota, and Joe was driving me to Austin, I think, or driving me from Austin back to St. Paul. And Joe raised the question with me would I consider running for president? And I laughed it off. And I made it very clear that I not only hadn't considered it, but I wasn't about to. And I don't remember now very clearly whether I said to him, and on top of that, Tony, I think it's the logical candidate, and I think he's going to be running. And I wouldn't get into this kind of an argument with Tony, even assuming I wanted to do it. And I went on to say at some point to him, you know, it's really almost unheard of a lawyer becoming running for the president of the union. And to which Joe replied, well, maybe unheard of, but you're the logical person. You're the only one who can really pull this thing together. You've been doing the work. Well, we debated it back and forth for a little while. We never went into real detail. And I left it, and that was that. Now, I have no recollection, absolutely none, of this question being raised with me until I got to Montreal. Now remember, the board got to Montreal a week before the convention started, or roughly a week, I'm not exactly certain. And there was all kinds of politicking going on among the board members and between the board members, and this thing kept coming up every once in a while. Now Ullman was there, because as I recall it, at that time he was a member of the board. And so I sort of figured that he had started it, but I wasn't sure. I had no way of knowing how it started. And Tony began then to say, that's a great idea, you do it.
These were private discussions with you.
Well, they were private discussions with me, or groups of guys who were doing it, and they were putting this kind of pressure on me. I was under tremendous tension, this I remember, because as I think I mentioned to you the other day, I had an adjoining room to Clark's with a door that went through, and there was a certain amount of things I had to carry on with him, and it was getting embarrassing as hell, and he with those, you know, that absolutely faceless look of his almost. Every time I looked at him, I began to feel guilty and to feel bad, and I didn't know what to do, what to say, really, where to go. One of the things, this was just a few days before the issue had to be faced, or maybe it was just a day or two, the reporters from all the Chicago newspapers who were there, and I think I can remember, I think I'm right when I name the following people. There's George Hardman of the Trib, Justin McCarthy, I think he was the Sun-Times.
Yes.
Jim Penniff.
That was Sun-Times.
That's right, but they were both there. So one or the other may have been with AP or UP or I know at one point Jim Penniff took over the news bureau, but I'm not sure when. But I'm almost certain, I am certain that both McCarthy, there was the Daily News too then.
That would not have been Lewin at that time.
No, this was long before Lewin. So maybe Justin McCarthy was with the Daily News, although I don't remember him with them. Or Penniff, whatever it was, I remember those guys. And it seems to me there were a couple of other guys in there. I think they were the AP-UP people, and I don't think I knew them so well. Well, these guys start putting all kinds of heat on me. And they begin telling me what a great story this is. New Times in American labor history. Not only that, but look what you can do for these people. Mm-hmm. Isn't it much better doing this than being a lawyer? And, you know, it was a different period, too, when the challenges really, how creative and how worthwhile was it. Now, that had a big effect on me. And my recollection is that was the Saturday night before before the convention. And I can remember spending almost a sleepless night. They didn't leave me until about 1 o'clock in the morning or later. And you know, they were talking, and for all I know, we were drinking. I don't remember too clearly. Mm-hmm. But their voices would get loud, and I could think of Clark on the other side of that door. And it was really... I was really all tied in knots over this. The following morning, I called Rachel. And I told her what was going on. And, this visit I'd had the night before. Rachel had not been able to come to that convention because Tony had been born just a few weeks before. This was in 1946, and Tony was born the end of April, April 27th, 1946. And so, I wasn't about to do this without her agreeing. And I remember very clearly saying to her, you know, this is apt to mean a totally different kind of a life than the one we thought about. In many ways, it's apt to be more exciting. In other ways, be more destructive. I just don't know. But what do you, how do you feel about it? And all she would say was, well, you've got to follow your own instincts and your judgment. Whatever you want to do, I'll support. But it's got to be your decision. I can't make it for you. Well, obviously she couldn't, and I really wasn't asking her. I guess I wanted to hear what I heard. Because I, in retrospect, I can tell you that the urge to do this was very great. I had the feel, well, I can remember after I was elected, you know, the first time I took the gavel. The whole quality of that room
just changed.
And this was the kind of thing I had always dreamt of doing, you know. And so that there isn't any question that I unconsciously had the push. In the meanwhile, I also had this awful feeling about Clark. It was really almost a sense of shame rather than anything else. I mean, I don't know what else to call it, because I didn't think he was competent. That didn't require any special astuteness on my part. I knew very well that there wasn't a delegate in that hall who really thought so and would go out of their way for it. I knew what the pressures were that were coming on me to Haywood. Fully Fulton, if you remember, was running the convention. That was the time I got up to speak and talk because I wasn't a delegate. And I remember the question was even raised if I was a member. And I must say that Hank Schoenstein got up on the floor and he said he was sure that there were a lot of people who he worked with who would present this. But he felt the record ought to be clear. He was a member of, he was the treasurer, whatever he was, of Local 28. And that he could attest to the fact that I was a member in good standing, had been for over 3 months or whatever the convention occurred, of that local union. But he just wanted the convention to have that information. It had nothing to do with the way he felt about the issue or the way he voted. Well, that's it. Then, you know, the vote came, and at the very end, Haywood had sensed that Clark wouldn't make it if it ever came to a vote, because he'd been kind of, he had a lot of pressure on Dowling, you know, and the Canadian. Dowling had told him what there was any question. Dowling kept repeating what Clark had told McLean that time, McLean had said 10 cents or 10% of it. And Clark had said, well, which is it, Mr. McLean? 10 cents or 10%? And we were talking about a dollar. So McLean, Fred never got over being embarrassed by that, you know? And they could have talked from now until doomsday, and they never would have changed his mind. Plus the fact that by that time, Fred and I had developed a very good and close relationship. And, well, so Clark withdrew at the last minute, and then that nomination of Clark for Secretary of Treasury just blew everybody's head, and no one was prepared for it, and no one could think fast enough to say, okay, let it go, we'll go ahead and nominate Reggie, which is what we had intended to do, all that, understanding that your thing about Denver, too, but at that time, Norm was going to be our candidate.
Absolutely.
And, which is what we really should have done, but we didn't, and as much because both Fred and I just lost our guts. We felt that Clark would get so much sympathy from his withdrawal and his desire to bring about unity and his contribution to unity that he could just win. And that would make it even worse if you had to work with a guy at Beachhead after rather than. And so Richie name and Clark was elected by acclamation. Well, that's the way I remember this story. And that's why I was somewhat surprised that you're saying that I had been listening to him. But I had absolutely no reason to believe. I knew that Tony wasn't going out beating the bushes. I knew he wasn't really working hard at it. But I it never occurred to me that that he wouldn't do it at the time when it became essential to do it. And, you know, this has been going on for several months. So, and he was very ambivalent. He would say to me one day that he was going to run, the next day that he wasn't. But I always had a feeling that I could talk him into doing it if push came to shove. There were real problems, of course, because there were a lot of people who didn't like him. You know,
it was like Tony.
So the question of whether he could beat Clark was a real question, especially with the CIO support that everybody sort of expected Clark to get, because they felt that he was their man. Well, that's the way I remember this story. And that's why I was a little surprised. Now, you say your memory is that Tony told you that...
No, Tony never mentioned your name. He told me that he was running, or talking about running, but that he really didn't think that he would do it.
That could well
but
be.
But he said that there'll be somebody else. And that, but until somebody stands up, he says, I'm going to stand up. That's where he was putting it, see. Now, I also say that it is my recollection, although I cannot pin down the moment at which I had been told, but that before I was on the train headed into Montreal, that I had the inkling that you were going to be the candidate.
Well, I can't imagine where you got it. Although I can't say
these guys had dropped it on me that that's where they were going. Now my assumption was that you had been clued in on it.
Wow.
But apparently that's where assumptions go awry.
Well, all I can tell you is that if I had.
Mm-hmm.
I had handled it in the same way that I handled it with Joe. Now, maybe Joe had told these guys that he had talked to me and that they were going to have to work on it. I don't know, although Joe, you know, his relationship in those early days with Herb and these people was not as close as it later became, because they had that long history of political problems. So it never occurred to me that, as a matter of fact, there is a piece written by a guy by the name of Ken Krause, K-R-A-U-S-E, as I remember it, that appeared in the St. Paul paper after the convention, in which he analyzes the selection. And he says it was the most astonishing, I don't know that he used the word astonishing, but it'll do, group and coalition that anyone can imagine.
Disparate.
He said on the one hand you had the Trotskyites from Minnesota, on the other hand you had Stalinists from different parts of the country. You had just plain ordinary trade unionists, you had some very conservative people, you had the Social Democrats from Canada, and all of them gathered around this guy,
lawyer,
and supported him. And you know, at the time it hadn't occurred to me, but the fact is he was right.
Mm-hmm.
And in later years I realized that. Me a while. I was mattering hell at him at the time. But I don't know why, because he was right. Except that I didn't think he had to identify everybody according to politics. It seemed to me it had been, whatever unanimity was there more on the basis of their response to competence than to,
political
operation. Because clearly they weren't agreed on it as a political matter, I wouldn't have thought. Well, that's my recollection. Yeah. Now, it could very well be, and I would be the last to deny it, that a lot of these guys have been kicking this thing around for a long time because they were getting increasingly desperate. I remember that about a candidate. Tony had held himself out. Whether he did that in agreement just to keep things down, that I don't know. But he had held himself out. But he was really not very acceptable to an awful lot of people. And I think that many of them...
For good reason.
Well, yeah, whatever. Well, at that time, I don't know. Except he was young then.
That's
and
right.
Very immature and inclined to be fighting to go off. And they were getting, they kept looking around and
there was nobody there.
More competent people couldn't do it because of some political problems they had.
Who was more competent? Well,
I don't know. Herb was a real mass leader, and I always thought. I don't know that he would have been more competent in terms of unifying the Union and that kind of deal. But they could very easily have come to the conclusion at some point, look, you got to do it, that this is the only way we can do it. And I can tell you one other thing. One of the things, and I sensed that at the time, I didn't know where it was going, I sensed it at the time. One of the things that brought people like those that Herb represented, those that Joe Ullman represented, those that Fred represent, and you know, the real mavericks out of the packing house, the conservative, they were conservative on most questions, but they
militants
out of the packing house. One of the things that brought them together was my performance in that January of 46 strike, when I pointed out to them that we could not be held to be in violation of the law until after the time for seizure went into effect. And the thing for us to do was to say we were not going back to work, we could reconsider our position if we felt we had to, we had that whole 24-hour period or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. We could reconsider our position if we had to, and then I wrote that strong, nasty statement, which I attacked Truman, the whole administration, and the headlines, you know, were I was sitting in a War Labor Board hearing. I wasn't at that meeting, at that convention. When, you know, they call everybody in to make a policy decision. We had a policy conference going on
yes.
the day they seized the plants or announced that they were going to seize them as of midnight. And it was at the Amalgamated Hall on Ashland. And on, I remember there was a piano on the platform. It's funny how little things. And that's where the telephone was. And it was from that telephone that Lou talked to Anderson when Anderson called him, mm-hmm. pleading with him to go back to work, mm-hmm. not to create problems. And Lou never was so militant in his life as he was from there. And I went from there over to this War Labor Board hearing, and I pick up the newspaper and hear the Chicago Daily News and great mm-hmm. big, I don't know whether they were inch or 2 inch headline, Union defies government. And it was the first time so far as I know that that had happened except for John Lewis during the war. But for any other mm-hmm. union to do it, I think it was the first time. Well, that did pull a lot of these people together, and it may have got them started thinking about me, and they may have had a lot of conversations. I can't say they didn't. And I can't even say that some of them didn't come up and suggest it to me, but I brushed them all off the same way I brushed Ullman off, because I had this strong sense that these guys in
really?
The shop really wanted a pecking house work. So I think if you were questioning my what I have said about this up to now, you might question the fact that I could have been that naive. But I don't think that it's a matter of being candid. I think this is the way I remember the incident. I do not recall my actually facing the issue until I got to Montreal.
Well, in the aftermath, after the convention was over, how do you recall your reception by the packing house workers? Was there a
I would run into, every once in a while, I would run into some nasty stuff. One person, for instance, who really provoked me at one time, and he wasn't the kind of a guy that I should have been provoked by either. You remember Flanagan out of Albert Lea?
Yeah.
He was the leader of the Albert Lea local in those days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tall,
yes,
good-looking, wavy-haired. Flanagan kept talking, you're all right, Ralph, but you're not a packing house worker. And I finally got mad. And I think it was to Flanagan that I said this the first time, and then every time it came up, I repeated it. I finally said to him, look, you're right, I never worked in a packing house. Never came near a knife, the kind you use in a packing house, or any other of the instruments you use in a packing house, except on the occasions that I've gone through the packing house. And I would say to him, and I want you to know that I've gone through more packing houses than the leaders of any union have gone through their plants. Because I had. That was one of the things I started doing right away. And I said, tell me in what way has my being a lawyer hurt the packing house worker? Could I have helped them more if I had not been a lawyer but have been a packing house worker? Can you think of something I could have done if I was a packing house worker that I couldn't do because I was a lawyer? And he said, I never thought of it. I said, maybe you ought to start thinking. And from that time on, that's what I said. But it continued, well, it was very, very much evident in 48. It was one of the big arguments that Gottfredson and that group had used. But I think that by 50 or 52, surely, it was no one ever even remembered it. And that's what makes this thing that I brought with me, by the way, that Mueller dug up. He had it photocopied, that leaflet that the meat cutters put out.
Oh, yes.
Announcing how terrible it was that a lawyer became president of the union. Don't forget to have me give that.
Okay. Well, now, you mentioned that you'd made a policy of going into as many packing houses as you could. That was consciously in order to do what?
Well, it was conscious in order to do several things. One, I wanted to get the feel of what it was to work in the back. I understood very well. I understood this because of my whole background and lots of reasons. But I understood that it wasn't enough to know how a person felt or to understand it. You had to somehow project yourself into those people so you felt like they felt. And I realized that I could never accomplish that unless I worked there, unless I started punching a time clock and did all the other things they did. But at least I could get the smells of it. I could get some of its ugliness, some of its sounds, some of its the whole ambience of it, the feel of it. But there was only one way I could do that, and that was to spend time in these houses. And in my early days, when I first went to Austin to negotiate that annual wage contract, they had to take me out and buy me a couple of quick drinks because they did it on purpose too. They took me through near the scalding bed, and the smell and the heat of that thing, I almost passed out. But I made myself go through whatever that was, and I used to make it a practice. And then I also had the feeling that it was important that these people see me and get to know me. And I developed a technique that I've always used since. It stood me in good stead, actually. It was very hard for me to remember names. Well, it's hard for everyone to remember names unless you're Jim Farley, actually. And then I don't know for how long you can remember them. But what I did was to develop the technique of tying faces to places. And as a result of that, I'd see some guy somewhere at a convention or at a district conference or someplace. And he'd come up to me and shake hands and say, I bet you don't remember me. And I'd say, oh, of course I remember you. I met you at such and such a place. And you were standing over there. I have a good photo, whatever you call it, photographic memory, and I could do this, and you'd be amazed. It was more important that I do that than that I mention their name. And then I just took it for granted, and it was very simple somewhere along the line if it was important for me to say to him, by the way, your name slipped me. I just can't pull it back, but by this time he knew I knew it. And it wasn't important that he had to tell me his name. The third thing that I did very consciously was to understand that one of the ways of understanding how the guy in the shop felt, and that was important to me, by the way, because I had to represent him. And it wasn't enough to tell what his complaints were. I had to be able to understand why he felt the way he felt and why he had that complaint. And that meant that I had to understand his feelings as well as what he thought and how he reacted. One of the things that I started doing very early on, well, remember, after I was elected, I continued as attorney for the union for a couple of years, which is one of the things that made some of this possible. But was to handle grievances. I took every call that would come in for me. Guy, I never have had an unlisted telephone number. And when some of my colleagues who were presidents of unions heard that, they thought I was crazy. They'd tell me so.
Mm-hmm. You were getting calls at home.
Sure, I get calls constantly. There were times when Rachel would just get furious because I couldn't finish eating. She'd take the phone off the hook sometimes, and other times she would answer the phone saying, no, I'm not home. I'd get calls in the middle of the night. It was nothing for me to get a call 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And half the time those calls were guys, one of my members very clearly, coming out of Sioux City, Iowa. They were in a bar, drunk as hell. And they got into an argument about seniority, and so they picked up the phone and they called me up to have me tell them what the right interpretation of seniority was. And here am I trying to talk to these guys who I can tell are drunk.
Uh-huh.
But I felt that I had to understand it. And part of the thing that happened was that they really believed that I understood the way they felt. Or at least I think they did. I like to think they did. One of the things, Les, remember our negotiations, how many people we'd have sitting in those rooms?
Yes.
But do you remember the order we used to be able to keep?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was completely disciplined. One of the reasons was their trust and confidence. And part of that came out of these things that I taught. I don't, if I had gone in there like, I assume a guy...
Dave McDonald.
Yeah. But not Dave McDonald, because he, after all, never worked in a steel mill either. But even a Walter Reuser, I don't think I could have carried it on. Because Walter, at least, had worked in an automobile plant, you see, and he had that advantage. So I guess he wasn't a good example. But this was a very important part of it, and I started it very quickly. Allow much time to elapse between my beginning these things. And I'd go way out of my way. I remember one time being in Phoenix, and we had a strike there. We had organized what was known as Rosarita.
I remember it. Mexican foods.
Mexican foods. And I insisted that, who was it, Marion Ramon?
If I'm not mistaken,
I don't think so.
No, it was not Marion.
Could have been Buck, but I don't think so. I don't think it was in George's district.
No, no, no. It was in California's district.
No, Arizona.
Arizona was part of the.
Well, I don't know who it was, but whoever the rep was who was working, I insisted that he drive me out there, and I got those people together. Visited, we talked to him, spent several hours with him. Couldn't go into the plant because it was shut down. Didn't let me in anyway. I had similar experiences with the sugar workers when we had that long strike in 1955.
What company was that?
Well, Gottschalk and also Colonial. We had going in both places at once. That's the time when I was cited for contempt, and then went down there and asked them to arrest me. That was an interesting experience, because I had to get my kids out. You know, Louisiana, for me, was a foreign country. And I got them together and said, you know, I'm going down there. I've been cited for contempt, and I could end up in jail. And we just thought and all about it. They were just little girls, about 55. In the 40s, they were in 19, possibly. But I can recall speaking at some of those meetings, and they were substantially black, although not completely. And, well, you know how blacks many times will respond. I can remember the way these people had been out for months by this time. No, that's right, glad. Gotcha, and especially lasted for 8 or 9 months after that. And how they'd say, they'd respond, you know, hallelujah.
Yeah.
Amen. You're right. Or, I don't recall all the things they'd say. It was a very, some of those things, one other example, for instance, and I don't know why we're doing this here, because it's in there already, but one other example of something that happened there. I went down a year before this, that long strike at Gottschalk. I went down to a meeting at Gottschalk's, and that was when, before the shift in political allegiance had occurred. And I think Tony Sanji was president then, and I don't recall whether Chester Driver was active. He may have been Stewart or something. But I got reading, Gottschalk put out a statement of policy which they distributed to all their employees. And one of the things was that they would set up a club, and everybody could join the club for a very nominal fee, I think it was $2 a month, maybe $2 a you didn't amount to anything. If you belong to the club, you could see a movie once a week or twice a week. I'm not certain now how often. But they bring in a movie and they play it. And, there are other entertainment that they supply. So I remember saying to Sanji, you know, how do people feel about this? He said, oh, they like it. They think it's very good. They're very appreciative of the companies doing this, providing all these events that they provide. And I said, well, you know, this is the kind of paternalism that's responsible for a lot of your problems. I think this ought to be openly attacked. Oh, no, no, stay away from me. I said, well, I'll think about it. I wasn't prepared to give him a commitment that I would, because I had this very strong feeling that until we broke through some of this kind of stuff, we were in real trouble. So I come into this gym. It was the company's gymnasium, our auditorium. That's what the auditorium for the town was. It also served as a basketball court, for field events, or track events. And on each side, they had bleachers that went up, and I walk in, and here sitting on one side of the room, blacks. On the other side of the room are whites, and pretty evenly divided in numbers. It must have been, well, I would have guessed that over 90% of the plant was there, because as I remember, in those days, they employed about 900 people, and they must have been close to that in that room. And so I start my speech. I go on at some length. They had a Catholic priest there by the name of O'Connell, who was a Jesuit, and he gave one of these fire-eating speeches before I spoke that really. If I had said half of those things, they'd have had me in jail before I got out of there, you know. But in his case, I guess that was everybody expected it from. And of course, he had, he hadn't done it because he knew what I was going to do, and he didn't do what I did. I then began to analyze the issues that were before us. A major issue, of course, was that North-South differential, which was at that time over 40 cents an hour. It was close to, well, it was closer to 60 cents than 40, I think. Whatever it was a very substantial wage differential. And I said, and finally I worked myself around to the point in my speech where I said, and you know, I got a booklet here which talks about this club that the company has been so gracious as to set up. I assume that there are people who find this their only way of providing, getting diversions and entertainment, and I can understand that they would be very responsive to the company because of it. But how many of you wouldn't prefer to eliminate this differential, which would be a minimum of $16 a week if it was 40 cents an hour, or if it was 60 cents, it would be a minimum of $24, and I think that's what it was. And then take your family maybe once a week, put them in your car, which I would do, and drive into New Orleans and go see any movie you wanted, not one that they gave. Well, that place almost went up in smoke. I thought, I was afraid the bleachers were going to come down because they were just standing in their feet. And then I figured,
now I've got them.
I not only figured, now I got them, but now I got a really put the clincher in. And I said, you know, the company does this knowing and it with intent. It's not out of kindness, although they may be kind. It is because it is a way of keeping you divided on a basis where you feel that the company is your friend and anyone who tells you different is not your friend. I said, look at you in this room. Look at yourselves. Look how divided you are. Blacks on this side, whites on that side. Do you think you'll ever get that differential eliminated so long as you're able to, so long as you maintain this kind of division? Well, it was just smoke. And I finished up pretty quickly after that. I noticed coming across the floor, they were just so excited. Not just the blacks. The whites responded to it because they understood what it was to divide. I went into this old British Empire stuff of divide and conquer. You know, it wasn't just as simple as I stated it. It was a much more complicated kind of thing that pointed out where this led. But after I finished, I'm standing there visiting with people who were coming up, and I noticed coming toward me was a phalanx of about five or six people, well-dressed. And I said, how the hell are you? And I turned to Tony or someone who's standing there, and I said, that's the Gauchos and the superintendent of the plant. They sat there all through this thing. And they came up. One of them was at Yale. Another one had been at Harvard or was still at Harvard. You know, and I don't know where the other. They wanted to set up a meeting for me the next day with their fathers and uncles the people who really ran the business. And I must have told you this story, but I went there and we had a meeting. And it was perfectly clear very soon. One of these Gauchos, he looked like an Arrow Collar ad, but the well-dressed man who was 65 or 70 or where, handsome guy with a big florid face and a gray mustache and gray thick hair. The other one was well-dressed, fastidious, but the third one sat in a wheelchair. I was sympathetic then, I must say, but I can be even more sympathetic now because he's so arthritic ridden that he could hardly move. And in constant pain, which he controlled, man of tremendous than his sons turned out to be, or his nephews, whatever they were. And we argued for a bit about a number of things, and all of a sudden, and you could see that for him this was the end of the something was coming to an end. He turns and he says to my committee, who I had there, had an open mouth, said, you know, I don't understand this. We've been good masters, haven't we? I looked at it, and you know, it was something out of Faulkner. It was hard for me to believe. I wanted to see first if anybody on the committee would say something. Dead silence. I think they were scared of me as they were of him. My Lord, no, they were scared stiff of him. And I finally said to